Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, we try to answer the burning question, just who made Paris Hilton famous? And more to the point, how does anyone get famous these days? And how does fame affect musicians, their fans, and their music? What expectations do we have of musicians once they get famous? To discuss all of this, we're joined on the phone by our old friend Anne Powers, the chief pop music critic of the LA Times. Anne, good to talk with you again.
Hey, how are you doing?
All right. We're also joined on the phone by David Marshall. He's the author of several books, including The Fame Game and Celebrity and Power, Fame and Contemporary Culture. David, thank you for joining us as well.
It's good to be here.
Anne, let me start with you. Why do we tolerate the fame of people like Paris Hilton?
Well, I didn't think we'd do more than tolerate it. I think we make it happen. in a way, Paris Hilton is a very old kind of phenomenon. She's a debutante. Back at the turn of the century, and David could probably say something about this, you know, people used to pay in New York to stand behind glass walls and watch society people have parties. So, I mean, we've always been fascinated with high society, and she's that on one level. In another way, she's very modern in that she's a multi-branded object of interest. So she's something people can buy, whether they're buying her various products, her perfumes, they're planning on staying in one of her eventual hotels. And really her quote-unquote art, her music, for example, is just another element of the branding.
Mm-hmm. David, is it fair to say that that she is someone who is famous for being famous?
To a degree. I would agree with Anne that she draws on that era status, which is something very old. But I would say that there's an emptiness about Paris, which provides a debate about fame itself. Mm. And I think that's part of what Paris is about. She's almost the epitome of the kind of drive to fame that has been part of our culture for quite a while, but has intensified in the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, when you say a drive for fame, David, do you mean on the part of someone like Paris Hilton, or is it a drive on the part of society as a whole that we need to have these people in these positions?
Both. So on the first level, Paris is very much willing herself to be famous, and she's very skillful at it, and it has become a skill in and of itself that probably identifies something, the other element, which is it's almost a psychological or social psychological tick in our society that we're in this kind of recursive loop. It's like watching Entertainment Tonight and saying, oh, look how well this box office demonstrates how popular this film is. And then we say, well, we should be really interested in that film just because it has this amount of people going to see it. It's recursive in the sense that we have this almost psychological motivation in our society to be interested in fame in and of itself. That here's someone famous. Oh, let's watch this person who's famous.
Right. So it becomes a kind of a loop. You know, it's like almost like biofeedback. And should we assume that most musicians who are getting themselves into a position where they will, if they're successful, be putting themselves out in front of a public repeatedly? Should we assume that they have some kind of hankering after fame?
Yeah, and you could go first.
Oh, sorry. I think it's a really mixed bag in some ways. I mean, First, on this, just because I want to talk about Paris Hilton only all the time, I just have to note that her record didn't sell very well in the end. It hasn't sold very well. It was actually kind of a flop. So while I think we are interested in consuming her, we might not be so interested in always consuming every product she puts out. But that's an aside. As far as musicians wanting fame, there are certainly musicians who, well, any performer needs to want, you know, their work to get out there to a certain extent, unless there are very strange examples like this guy Jandek, who completely was anonymous for most of his career. He's recently begun performing. He's a very eccentric underground performer. He's probably in his 50s or 60s now. He's been putting out records for 20 years or something.
Yep.
But that is by far the exception. However, I think almost always when I talk to musicians, pop musicians, especially rock musicians, I would say, or ones that aren't part of the pop machine so much, they're very distressed by the fact that the time they get to actually make music is a very small percentage of what they do. I was reading an interview with Beck the other day where he was talking about how you make a record in 2 weeks to a year, and then you spend the next 2 years promoting it, you know, and how frustrating that can be. So I think they want fame in the abstract, but what it actually takes to be famous becomes a drag.
Yeah. Now,
go ahead.
David, let me just follow up with something. And a group like OK Go, you know, I mean, if they are in the pop machinery or seem to be wanting to get into the pop machinery, I think at that point, you have to say these guys know what they want. And in the case of OK Go, launching themselves with a dance competition on YouTube, they seem to know how to get it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think, and David might have some interesting things to say about this, the way that people are getting famous and the sort of levels of fame and levels of buzz, it's really changing with the decentralization of media. And, I mean, on the one hand, everything's becoming more consolidated. On the other hand, you have people like that band, OK Go, from Brooklyn, who can make a funny video and it can get out there. But see, that's different than having to, you know, go on all the talk shows and do a European press tour where you're just carted around like, you know, like the Venus Hottentot, frankly, of pop or something. And I think a band like that, well, another interesting thing about that band particularly is that in the videos, they have another person who's not their singer lip sync the vocals. So they're playing a joke on the public, even in terms of their persona right there. Mm. I think it's the bass player who pretends to be the singer. So these are very self-aware young people who've come up in the era of the internet, and they like to play around with public image. It's a game for them, you know?
Well, this is the band OK Go and their song A Million Ways. And toy and turn and chat and charm and hiss and play in the crowd. Play that song again. Another couple clown up in a nod, a glance, a half-hearted bow. Oh, such grace. Oh, such beauty. And lipstick and callus and fishnets and malice. Oh, darling. OK Go, they really have launched themselves by using the website known as YouTube, among other things. We're talking about fame, what comes with it, what does it do to an artist. We'll be opening the phones to you, our listeners, in just a few minutes. But right now we're speaking with Ann Powers, chief pop music critic of the LA Times, and David Marshall, who is the chair of the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University and wrote the book The Fame Game, among others. David, Ann mentioned before that, you know, you don't have to be Paris Hilton anymore. All you need is YouTube, you know. Access to the internet seems to be the great leveler of the playing field.
Yeah, I would say the internet or the web, whatever term you wanted to use, has kind of democratized the idea of fame. It doesn't mean that you're going to get it. It's everyone can produce a website or a video that kind of looks the way that fame was produced by major media industries in the past. And so what we're in an era of is the possibility of fame. that can be achieved in really innocuous kind of ways. And you, as you described, YouTube is one of those channels right now. Other ones existed in the past. You know, we've already forgotten about JennyCam, where this person just had a camera in their apartment, and we kind of watched her pursuits. I think there are elements of this democratizing of fame that have kind of percolated through the internet and has produced partly, not completely, but as part of reality television as well. We've got that sort of basically that fame can be produced anywhere, and television as an industry has sort of said, okay, we will still produce it better than you will on, you know, YouTube, but we'll try to construct it as if it's, you know, unmediated, even though it's highly mediated.
So are we reaching the point where Andy Warhol's famous statement about everybody's going to be famous for 15 minutes, that this is actually, you know, coming closer to being a true statement and not some kind of provocative thing?
Well, there's 15 seconds if we go by YouTube sort of characterization.
Yeah, I guess.
Maybe 1.5 seconds might be closer to it as well. I think we're in that state of a kind, an era of a kind of a narcissism that's going through right through the culture. And as well as that, a kind of voyeurism that, you know, YouTube is part of, like watching these sorts of things. And I would say heightened voyeurism, that voyeurism has always been part of, say, watching films or watching, you know, pop music performers. But I think we're in this era of always trying to see more of what is really motivating people. And so we have all sorts of things, all sorts of websites where we can, you know, go on Gawker Stalker and sort of follow where someone is in New York City at that particular time. Or we can go on a blog where the artist who might be famous is actually communicating with his or her fans.
Right.
So it's
I like the use of the term voyeurism. Ann Powers, I mean, we've seen over the years that some of the most famous pop stars actually, there's a kind of fatigue that sets in from, you know, being watched constantly.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, Dylan is a great example of that. Certainly, the indecipherable complexity of Michael Jackson, you know, a creature created by fame in a lot of ways and then eaten by it. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, it's interesting. Most people probably think his breakdown came a little later in the Beach Boys' career than it did, but it was on the very first airplane flight to take their very first tour that he had his first nervous breakdown. So, you know, certain people were just not made for these times, as he said. They were not,
right,
as Brian Wilson wrote in a song. You know, they may be musical geniuses, but the list of those kinds of people goes on and on. Prince is another one who, you know, the way he gets into the spotlight. And I think Prince is an interesting example of someone who had a traumatic life event. He, you know, he had a child who died, a stillborn child, and after that you really saw him retreat a lot. That's another thing that happens. Like, people who are famous don't always count on, you know, when they need privacy, when there are moments in life when you need privacy, even, you know, even if you're Mel Gibson.
Right.
And, you know,
especially if you're Mel Gibson these days.
Yeah. I mean, they don't count on that moment when they're out of control, that moment when tragedy strikes, those kinds of moments. There was an interesting example recently. There's a show on MTV, Run's House, about the Reverend Run from Run DMC, and all through this reality television show, his wife was pregnant. Well, the baby was stillborn. Again, the biggest tragedy I can imagine as a mother happening. And, you know, of course they retreated, but, I mean, what happens to the audience of that reality television show, and how do they respond to that? You know,
no,
it's not what reality television is supposed to be. The thing about reality television is that it's not really real, you know. The crises are all manufactured. So when reality, when actuality breaks in, and this is true in music too, I think that's why, you know, live performance is in a really weird place right now, where the most popular live pop bands are the older bands, the bands whose audiences really crave that physical connection, the Rolling Stones and Fleetwood Mac and bands like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the younger bands, the audiences don't seem to need to see them as much.
Right. Now, David Bowie and his song Fame, you know, mm-hmm, takes a kind of sidelong look at the whole phenomenon. Interestingly enough, a song he co-wrote with John Lennon, who certainly knew a thing or two about dealing with fame. Maybe we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, Anne, and we're also speaking with David Marshall, we can talk a little bit about the impact of fame and whether you can actually hear that in an artist's output over the course of a couple of years. But at the moment, here's the song from David Bowie, co-written with John Lennon, and then we'll continue our conversation, open up the phones, and take some of your calls as well at 212-264-7483, 212-264-7483, and you can email us as well, soundcheck@wnyc.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and in just a short while, live music here in our studios by the Decemberists. They have a new record out, their first on a major record label after three successful indie releases. Right now, though, we're talking about fame, the upside and the downside. We're speaking with a couple of guests, and we'll be opening the phones to you as well at 212-264-7483. Do you want your rock stars, your music stars, to be larger than life? And if you're a musician, are you in it for the fame? What's, you know, what are the pros and cons of being in a situation where you are likely to be living your life, if you succeed, in the public eye? Ann Powers is chief pop music critic of the LA Times, and David Marshall is the author of the books The Fame Game and Celebrity and Power, Fame and Contemporary Culture. And let me come back to, you were giving us some examples of pop musicians, rock musicians, who for whom fame turned out to be definitely a double-edged sword. We just heard Nirvana. Kurt Cobain certainly, you know, there were troubles there before he became famous, but fame seemed to exacerbate them.
Yeah, I think with Kurt, it was such a constellation of problems. I mean, he was a depressed person. He had physical problems. He was a heroin addict. But at the same time, the hothouse that fame put him in, and also coming from a moment in rock, this whole idea of the indie rock ethic, where getting very successful, and especially in the corporate music world, was something of a stigma among his peers. Ironically, that is completely gone by the wayside. You know, I think he felt a bit, he felt somewhat remorseful in a weird way about his success. Interestingly, you're having the Decemberists on. I just interviewed Colin Molloy recently, and his description of the indie rock ethic was, you establish yourself and then you sign with a major label. In other words, I think artists now are much more aware of, let's get a solid base, a solid personal base, a solid work base, and then try for the fame and the success.
In other words, let's figure out who we are, right, as opposed to going to some big record company and letting them decide who we are.
Exactly, and let's have a private life, a real life, you know, maybe a family or people around us who we trust. I'd be interested to hear what David had to say about
that. Yeah, David, actually, Anne raises a good point. Would we even allow that sort of thing from our celebrities? I mean, doesn't that kind of come with the turf, that if you accept the responsibility of being a star, that you don't get to have a private life?
You're signing some sort of devilish agreement, I suppose. But as well as that, I think there may be more than in the past. There are way more possibilities of being independent and not part of a normal fame system. In other words, it's much easier probably to have a kind of cult following via the different techniques that democratize notion of fame that allows you to still have an income, which I think is part of the reason why people are drawn to these things. It might be a massive income, and certainly that's why the industries are drawn to it. But fame also has to be seen as this kind of commodity that has to be managed in a certain way. Maybe you are comfortable that your fame is constructed in a smaller environment, that there's only maybe 15,000 people in the United States and another 20,000 in Japan that know you. Mm. And that's fine. And you make enough and you do fine on that. But I think there is always that temptation to move, as Anne describes, from the independent, the sort of cult following, the internet minor world, into something that is constituted in the major media industries. But right now, I think it's quite possible to make a pretty good living at a manageable level of fame.
And I suppose, Anne, you've certainly noticed the rock snob effect, where, you know, you're a fan of a band, and as David says there, they're sort of doing it on a certain level, independent, maybe they have a cult following. Then suddenly something happens, you know, some critical mass is achieved, and they burst onto the mainstream, and then suddenly all their old fans are like, yeah, you know, I liked them back when they were really good. Now they're, now they're fill in the blank, usually sellout or words to that effect.
Right, that's been complicated lately with the whole, with the phenomenon of MySpace and YouTube. You know, the idea that you have a million friends or something on your MySpace page. Bands like Panic at the Disco getting signed and selling a lot of records before they even, you know, have barely recorded. I mean, they record like two songs and they're massively famous. Again, the indie ethic is kind of, it's changed. In hip-hop, it's interesting because probably the most successful and famous icon of hip-hop, living icon, is Jay-Z. And Jay-Z is known as a great artist, but he's also a businessman. He's the CEO of Def Jam Records. He's, you know, he always promoted himself as a businessman. And even, like, he came from the projects where he was involved in some shady activity. But, you know, it's like his corporate image was as important as his artistic image. And that was such a wise move, in a way, because any kind of corporate or commercial success he had only fed his image and only made him more impressive to his fans. And so that kind of conflict you're talking about would never happen with someone like that.
Yeah. David, let me ask you about fame. Can it be manufactured? Is it something that just kind of happens, that gets thrust? Is it like greatness, you know, thrust upon people? Can you manufacture this kind of, this level of attention and buzz?
You can. You might not be able to sustain it without something underneath it. But I think it's definitely each of the industries thinks that they can manufacture it, or we wouldn't have all those different, you know, bands that have been produced, whether it's Take That or New Kids or any of a variety of ones from the past.
Right.
And the current versions of those sorts of things. There is that idea that you can be a Svengali. You can produce this structure of fame. Its sustainability sometimes depends on two things. One is, do they have skill or talent? And the other one is, back to Paris, since Anne wants to talk about Paris, that capacity to play in that making of the self. The thing about celebrity and fame is it's an incredible, intensified relationship about the self put into a public sphere. And if you're good at it, and someone else is good at making it for you, you could control that environment. The other aspect of fame is that we're always looking for the cracks, that as much as you control it, celebrity and fame is all about looking at the performing self, not in their normal performing place, but their everyday self for public consumption. In other words, it's the place of the paparazzi, or the
right
place where you reveal something more about yourself than you would in a performing environment.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, talking about Paris again and that emptiness that you see or that you don't see, and can fame be completely manufactured? The great examples are, of course, American Idol, Rockstar Supernova, the biggest phenomena of television. What's interesting about those programs in terms of musicians and musicianship is that, in fact, many of the winners and the finalists have actually had careers kind of quietly or perhaps unsuccessfully. In the case of someone like Taylor Hicks, you know, plugged along for a long time. In Rockstar Supernova, every single one of those finalists had, you know, had tried for many years to be a successful rock star. So then it's a funny relationship. It's like they jump onto the machine to succeed, and then their success feels empty. And we think of them as amateurs, and they're not. I don't know. It's sort of this weird, endless circle.
All right. Well, what about, let's take an example that's on the charts and has been for a little while, Fergie's London Bridge. I mean, this it'll be interesting to see whether she's in the midst of her proverbial 15 minutes or whether this turns out to be something longer lasting. Here's London Bridge by Fergie. All right, Ann Powers, I, without trying to make any kind of blanket statement about what's out there in the world of pop music, it does seem like there is a group of, you know, young female singers or singers slash rappers who are really interchangeable. I could just as easily say male as well. But you know what I mean?
That there's dirtier than all the rest, so...
But there's a kind of a cookie-cutter mentality. It seems like a lot of these... You know, it's hard to tell one from the other. They all sound alike. I mean, the age-old complaint of the older generation listening to the younger generation. But what I mean by that is they seem to be the product of the same kind of process.
Right. Well, Grandpa, let's say that, first of all, we can find that in any pop era. So you can find that in the 50s with the sort of Annette Funicello type thing, and with males, you know, boys, Frankie Avalon, Fabian. You can find it in the 60s in London with kind of those Carnaby Street girls, Marianne Faithfull, and all those kinds of people at the time before she went punk and got cool.
Yeah.
Et cetera, you know. So, and David alluded to the boy bands. That was a moment when everyone... So I'm not so like opposed to pop particularly. There is an interesting thing that's happening right now that I think connects with our larger conversation, which is that these young women are very open about their manufacturedness, in a sense.
Hmm.
They come from backgrounds like there may be like a Cassie, who is Diddy's protege. She was a model, and she can't really sing. And she doesn't seem to really mind that nobody thinks she can sing. You know, they're very young. They're in their teens. And then there's the whole sort of actress/ phenomenon.
So right,
you have
right.
Lindsay Lohan and Hilary Duff and all the Disney stable. So there's a comfort level with, you know, not being a quote-unquote artist. Fergie's a little different in that she at least claims to have a rough past. She says she was a meth addict at one point. And she's a little older. I think she's 26 or something. But again, the manufactured nature of the music, the skills, the artistry, if you would call it that, are really about functioning and working within a machine.
Right.
And then you have an interesting person, Lily Allen, who I don't know if you've heard, comes from England, daughter of a famous famous sister mm-hmm. actor. She makes great music sort of on the underground grassroots side of things, but in some ways, she's equally manufactured. So,
well, Anne, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off there, Anne, because we are out of time. Anne Powers, chief pop music critic of the LA Times, David Marshall, author of the books The Fame Game and Celebrity and Power, Fame in Contemporary Culture. We have the Decemberists patiently waiting their chance to get into the studio and play live for us. So let me thank the both of you for joining us this afternoon. And to the folks who've called, sorry we didn't get to you, but time's a-wastin'. We have the Decemberists live in a moment. You're listening to Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.